Hi, friends, and welcome back to Sermonsmith. This is a podcast of conversations about the craft of sermon preparation. My name is John Chandler, and my guest today is my friend AJ Sherrill, who is coming to us from Chelsea in Manhattan in New York City in New York State. Just to be particular. How are you, AJ?
So glad you're particular. We're all pretty picky about our neighborhoods here in New York.
Is that so? Is that a thing?
Well, amongst us parish pastors, there's some great sibling rivalry that goes on throughout the course of the week.
So like, if you find out that somebody who lives in, you know, some other neighborhood, or somebody who lives in Chelsea is going to some other neighborhood, you know, congregation, do you brawl?
You know, I think it depends on the person. Sometimes we gladly bless them to other congregations. It just depends on what their reputation is in the community. No, that's all a lie. We're actually seriously close as brothers, and we have such a blast doing ministry together here. So speak tongue in cheek.
We should give context to the conversation that we're having right now, because you and I have spent time together in New York City before you lived there. But let's talk a little bit about where you are. You are at Trinity Grace Church in New York City, and you are the parish pastor for Chelsea. That's the context for all this conversation, but tell us about that. Tell us about Trinity Grace and the parish model that you have there, and then your particular role.
Yeah, so our parish model is really, we're not in a denomination. I say that with both lament, and yet there's also some things about that that allow us to be flexible to a very transient, flexible society here. Not necessarily doctrinally, but missionally more than anything. We're brothers that do ministry together. We go away together, and we've been given sort of spiritual authority over geographical proximity is the way that we talk about it. So New York is structured as a city by neighborhoods. And so we found it really helpful to structure our church in the similar way that the Catholic Church has done it for generations in that way. So we have parishes in about 9 different neighborhoods, and about to be 10 coming up on Easter, and don't have like an arbitrary number that we're going for. We're just kind of discerning the Spirit in the moment and allowing the Spirit to sort of move the sails, so to speak, and responding to that. So yeah, that's where we are.
So then how would your role be unique from what somebody who might be a pastor, you know, my role, you know, I'm a pastor of a neighborhood church in Austin. We don't have parishes. So how would your role be unique? Like, you're the pastor of that neighborhood / congregation, and what interplay do you have with maybe a core leadership of the church or the other parishes?
So each of our neighborhoods are missionally contextual, but we also consider ourselves across the city one church. So the way we like to talk about it is that we're really one church with many parishes. So we do a lot of collaboration together. Doctrinally, we're on the same page for the most part on issues that are orthodoxy and major doctrinal ways. But there's also just nuances that we have for each parish that that don't divide us or in any way segregate us, but at the same time allow for nuance and distinctives. Depending on the part of the neighborhood that you're in, it should look different in Crown Heights than it does in Chelsea, in Washington Heights than it does in the Upper East Side, for example.
Sure. So what are your primary responsibilities technically, are you called a parish pastor?
Yeah, I mean, on paper, and the word parish kind of breaks down in the Protestant tradition because that's not really utilized very much. So, I mean, we're called pastor, lead pastor of a neighborhood, or pastor. We're not really that particular about it. But my role would be the same as yours would be where you are in terms of my primary responsibilities are leadership, vision, and teaching are my primary roles within our parish here.
Yeah. And how often do you preach, since this is what this is about?
You know, I try to preach no more than 2 to 3 times a month. I'm actually, I'm really passionate about the fivefold ministry, and not just developing teachers, but also prophets that have the gift of teaching and evangelists that have the gift of teaching and apostles, etc. So we have, a group of people that we've raised up. And also sometimes it's nice to get the other parish pastors in to teach, just to continue to make sure that our congregations aren't built on one primary voice, but hear a sea of people. But we also know that they identify with one voice as well in terms of its primary leadership, et cetera. So 60 to 70%, I would say, at most.
Yeah. So I'm going to go off. I have like my role of, or my sketch of questions I always go through. I'm going off track right now. Because I love what you just said, and I want to hear when you say, you know, that you're raising up others or developing others, these would be lay people within your congregation?
It is. One of the things, though, that I would say about that is that we've gotten to a place at Chelsea where no longer do we view the pulpit as experimental, if you will. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when you're in the early stages of church planting or you're in the early stages of your ministry, you can kind of take some more risks given the more relational dynamic because the congregation is smaller.
Sure.
And I think as things scale in size, there's just a level of each role within each different environment that you create where we have found that the large environment, in terms of teaching, in terms of music, it doesn't need to be experimental. So we create other environments in our ministries, such as mid-sized communities and small groups where our teachers can learn to grow and develop. And then out of that, as they continue to grow in their gift, we really do long to see more that have the gift of teaching that are working in the fashion industry, let's say, or working in one of the industries of New York that we feel like have something to say about the gospel at work in the life of the city. So so there's two particular people that we have in our congregation that just have the gift of teaching that we wanted to see raised up and do a fantastic job at it. So we released them to do so.
Yeah. And how much are you involved in their preparation process then?
Early stages, very much, in terms of just helping them think through their voice uniquely in our community. And the more and more opportunities they get, the more they're free from that. So within 6 months, I'm more involved on the back end of giving them just healthy conversation of talking through what really worked well, what was sort of not as helpful. But in a way that we're also like not heavily programmatic where we're trying to where we want to be excellent and make sure that it's helpful. We're also not a corporate environment where you feel like, between services, we're back there trying to grill it out. And, I can be a bit cynical about that. But we do try to give constructive feedback to all of our teachers just so they know where they're really hitting stride and also areas of growth. So, and they love that. So,
and one more, I guess this is back to a context question, but what kind of space do you meet in?
So we meet in every space obviously across the city is unique to obviously the tyranny of what place you can find in a neighborhood, particularly like New York where it's contested space and very expensive. So for the past, since our conception in Chelsea, which has now gone on 7 years, we have been meeting and we'll continue to meet. We just landed a new contract with a beautifully gracious, congregation that is a German Lutheran evangelical church that have parishes all over the world, and they have they built an amazing structure in 1896 that we meet in Chelsea, and so they're German speaking and just some of the kindest people we've ever met, and have just opened their doors for us to proclaim the gospel and gather community.
And you do? Are you Sunday night then, and they use it Sunday morning?
Yep. Okay. We have gatherings on Sunday night, and they're Sunday morning.
Got it. So, AJ, what would you say is, and I don't know if this would be particular to Chelsea or if this would be across the board for Trinity Grace, but what would you say is the role of preaching in the life of your congregation?
I would think, first of all, I would say the role of preaching. We are Protestant, so it has a very dynamic role. At the same time, in terms of Chelsea, and I could speak on this lightly for the other pastors, but not definitively, sacrament is also a huge role in our parish, particularly the Eucharist at Chelsea. So for me, all preaching kind of culminates in the taking of the Eucharist, and that's for many reasons, one of which it makes sure that the proclamation that I'm giving always points to the good news found in Jesus, the cross and resurrection. So it's all always, that's sort of the telos of where everything is headed. Not to say every single character in the Old Testament, the answer is Jesus, although that you could definitely make a case for that.
You wouldn't be the first for sure.
At the same time, we would sort of honor their history as well and the life that they lived, though everything points to him as well. But I say that to say we want to make sure that the role of preaching is always moving toward event, is always moving toward formation and not necessarily tips for living, although, application matters. But I really have a big commitment to preaching as event. So, Bardian, I guess you could say.
I was going to go there. When I was alluding to, you would not be the first. What is the makeup? I mean, you've even alluded to this in an email, because I told you, hey, we have three people who used to be part of Trinity, or three couples, you know, in our church now. What is the makeup of your congregation? Is it very fluid? Is it mostly younger couples?
So I would say our church is representative of downtown Manhattan, or even downtown Midtown Manhattan. So our primarily demographic are working professionals between the ages of 25 and 40.
And do you find it is fluid then? Do you find it's a lot of people who are in Manhattan just for a short season and then move on?
You know, there are concentric circles in which people are here for longer stints than others. For the most part, you can kind of count on the typical downtown Midtown Manhattanite to be from somewhere else. And they come here early in their career and they end up leaving within about 3 years, or they move out to Brooklyn, Queens, or to Jersey, just for, you know, you can get some ease in cost of living. And Manhattan, although it's gained so many, taken so much ground in terms of cultivating family here in Manhattan, it still can be quite a challenge at times.
Yeah. So. Okay. Well, talk about your planning. Like, talk about how far out do you plan sermons? Is it something, are the sermon series that you do unique to Chelsea, or is that something you all do together, and the whole process for mapping all that out?
Yeah, so we use the church calendar. We really have found a real joy in allowing the church calendar to inform what we preach in many ways. Sometimes not just the church calendar, but the lectionary. It's really, I find it useful, and I take a page out of Willimon on this, and so many before him, obviously, but my recent influence has been studying with Willimon and really enjoying his influence in my life. And I have found that being told what to preach by tradition is a much more healthy place for me, at least, to be. It grounds me in the story rather than allowing my personal narrative or the arc of our community to be the sort of the sole determining factor of where we're going. So we use the church calendar as a whole. Typically, we are grounded in that with the same series per parish. We collaborate together on certain days of the week, depending on who's preaching. We share notes. However, there are times during ordinary time where we like to take sort of, parish-specific series to address certain needs in our congregation. So, like right now, we're in ordinary time. And what we in Chelsea have found, and a few of the other congregations are doing this as well, we're just walking through the Psalms this summer, and the Psalms given by the lectionary. Okay. So, we'll be doing that. We're studying 1 Peter this fall as a collective, and then when we move into Advent, we'll then walk into a series together and walk through all the way through Pentecost. So
when you're in those seasons together where you're all in the lectionary, are you all choosing to do the same passage?
If we're in the lectionary, yeah. In ordinary time, like I've locked us in for the Psalms. So if anyone wants to join me in this series, there are three of us amongst the 10 of us that are on the teaching team that kind of create the content of where we're going as teachers and then present it to the rest of the pastors for editing and for final draft. So of the three of us, each of us took a different direction this summer and invited the pastors to join us if they wanted to, or they could go their own route. So most, if not all of them, have joined one of the three of us. And so my vision for the summer was, because people are in and out so much from New York in the summer, and that's true almost anywhere in the States, we just wanted to glide through the Psalms, give ourselves to the lectionary, not do a heavy vision series because we know that people miss weeks a lot during the summer. And so whoever wants to join into that, great. Graphics are available, et cetera, et cetera. Or if you want to lock into another series, you can do that as well. So,
but say come Advent, will it be pretty much everybody will agree we're all going to do the New Testament passages during Advent or gospel passages or anything like that? Or is it still a kind of a free range? We're going to follow the lectionary, but pick any of the four.
Yeah. So that, you know, we're not, we love the structure of it, but we're not so tethered to it that there's no room for nuance.
Yeah.
So I say in one sense, We're all sort of in different stages as to how far we want to submit to tradition. I'm a little further along that commitment than some of our other pastors, and that's not good or bad. It is what it is. So, for example, when it comes to Advent, we would probably say something like last year we used the Isaianic texts and said, well, let's just preach through Isaiah and lock into that. However, if you find a life source in the gospel reading for that week that you feel like is just exactly what you sense the Spirit is wanting to say to your congregation, like, feel free to go from Isaiah and really hone in on Matthew or whoever the gospel writer is for that week. So there's some fluidity to it. And, you know, like I said, we're all in different neighborhoods. So Crown Heights is just so different than Tribeca. And so they need to feel some sort of freedom to minister to their people where they are. So,
yeah. Okay. Yeah. That even the reason I asked is, I think it was, I don't recall if this was Lent or Advent, but a few other pastors locally who I know use the lectionary, we agreed to have a study group and just get together and talk about, you know, what we were figuring out about the passage we're going to preach on that week. And it seemed like every time we got together, it was, oh, I'm going to do the Psalm this week. Oh, I'm going to do the Old Testament passage. So I wondered how much some of that collaboration would even help you.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about in particular then how AJ puts together a sermon. Walk us through your timeline from the time you know what a sermon's going to be leading up to, I guess, probably Sunday at 4 p.m. or whatever time you're wrapping it up. Take us through your steps and about how far out each of those pieces happens.
Well, I obviously know like a few months ahead of time, you know, where we're going, what the future series are most likely going to be. So that's always some sort of sticky note in my phone that I'm walking with and taking along and along. That's kind of like overarching stuff. But I think in terms of the course of a week, what that looks like, getting into the nitty gritty of the upcoming Sunday.
I love the nitty gritty. Bring it out.
There's five different steps that I take that I have found helpful, and at times really keeps me accountable to being faithful to the proclamation. And the first is the process for me is every Monday I start devotionally.
Okay.
Everything for me begins devotionally, and that's probably true, I would say, I hope the majority of pastors, if not more than that. The idea is that, you know, I want to make sure that whatever I am preaching has first found a root in me and has searched me. And so instead of reading the text, beginning to a place where I allow the text to read me. So I'll usually spend my Mondays not allowing myself to do exegetical work, organizational work, contextual work, or even sacramental work. It's all devotional in the sense of walking through Alexio Divina and just allowing the words of whatever the scripture that is going to be proclaimed that week that has been faithful to produce transformation for generation after generation to really get inside of me. And so that's sort of the first step that I would go with.
Is that Monday morning? Is that all day Monday? How long do you spend in that?
That's Monday morning. Yeah. And that is, that's typically for, you know, a good 30 minute just soak time into that and just moving into that to start my day. And what that does then, that just allows me to begin my week thinking with this text as my primary lens through my week. But again, like I really resist, and it's hard for me because I so quickly want to go to sort of amassing all the supporting illustrations and other texts and other thinkers who have weighed in on the topic or the theme or the text.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a good discipline for me. It's really good medicine. Because it really allows me to make sure that preaching isn't forging the sort of the fulcrum of my identity in terms of what I say and how well I say it and what people think about me as I say it, but really making sure that I'm being honest to be transformed by a text that I'm claiming is transformative. So devotionally would be the first step that I take on Monday. It's all that I allow myself to do. The second step would be, you know, Tuesday, such as today, before talking to you, I work on exegetically making sure that I'm beginning to understand the underpinnings of that text in its original language. Also, commentary is all been, you know, bring into that step in terms of, you know, who I'm really respecting for whatever, where I am in the text. For example, right now we're in Psalms, and I really respect Charles Spurgeon and Walter Brueggemann's work. when they come to those specific psalms. So those are kind of like, I would start to add layers at this point of that text exegetically. So that would be my next step, to make sure that I'm starting with the text rather than my ideas on a theme or a topic or a recent book I read that probably has a 2 to 3 year shelf life, you know, but really starting with the text.
Let me pause. Let me backtrack. Both Monday morning and now you're talking Tuesday exegetical. Where do you do this? You're in a small apartment with a 1 year old. Do you guys have an office you go to? Do you do all this at home? You do this all out and about in the city?
There's about 4 different environments that I have found. I'm really sensitive to bad lighting and ambient sounds. So my office is essentially a cave. It's really the Cave of Wonders that I can really lock in and really just kind of shut everything out in terms of that direction of needing to focus. So I have a crying 1 year old at many times, or a laughing 1 year old, mostly laughing.
Equally
crying.
Distracting.
And she's the cutest kid I've ever seen. So I find home is an awful place to really do any exegetical work. Those are typically, you know, private experiences somewhere where I can really, you know, get into silence.
So, but you have an actual office with that you have all your bookshelves in and all that, I take it.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And from there, from devotional to exegetical, I'll then move into organizational. I find that it's really helpful for me, and it's been a challenge because, like many preachers, you know, I studied homiletics for my first master's, but you don't really, you're so new into the craft, you're not really learning by the rearview mirror. You're kind of like learning, hoping you'll apply it. You don't really have a context or a canvas for it necessarily, at least a lot of experience that can serve as sort of a rebuke as to what your natural habits are that might not be healthy. And I have found that developing the organization of the message, let's say if you use 3 points, or if you like to use 3 illustrations or 3 metaphors or whatever, I have found that developing them from the exegesis of the text is really more faithful for me than developing it from some of the cultural nuance that I'll find a little bit later. Like, for instance, I love Mark Sayers. Mark Sayers, I feel like, is a really prophetic voice for our time. But I don't want to develop my sermon main points from Mark Sayers, as much as I feel like he is such a giant in the area of culture and sociology right now. I really want to allow the text to say what the text wants to say through my points, rather than what someone recently has said about it, if that makes sense. I don't think one way is necessarily right or wrong. I have just felt much more, it's been a great challenge for me to develop the organization of my content based on what the text is trying to say. So I'll usually go there next, rather than moving to contextualization or mission or a recent book I read, or looking at my own, you know, private catalog where I've just, you know, been able to create themes over the years that I can come back to. I try to develop my points out of the text itself. So that's been a really good thing for me, to just, you know, begin at that place.
So as you, sorry, I just stop you and ask questions. This is how it works. As you go through Tuesday and do all this exegetical work, which word studies, commentaries and the like, are you just scrawling all this in a notebook so that you can come back and start to see themes or a development of thought?
Yes. Yeah. Taking notes in the side, starting to jot down main ideas. Basically just trying to figure out what is this text, what is it trying to say? What does this text have to say in of itself? Mm-hmm. And let's start there and then see what God wants to then move that from that first century context or whatever century it might have been in, if it's an old covenant passage, into what God might be saying now. Like, it's really important to me to get to what it meant before what it means. And I'm not suggesting we can fully ever understand its historical rooting,
but I
do think there are some things we can know. And I think that's a really good place for us to begin.
Which, yeah, I mean, everything that you're saying tends that way. You know, when you're saying, I want to understand the text exegetically and organize around that, certainly invites what you just said. Do you, One of the things that's interesting to me that I feel like as I've learned as a pattern is I tend to organize sermons different ways all the time. And I find that I tend to have a lot of stress until I find the organizing principle for a sermon. Mm-hmm. You know, so do you often find that just by doing the exegetical work on Tuesday, that Wednesday you can pretty well make it all come together? Like, is it as clean as you make it sound for you?
It depends on how hard I force myself on Tuesday. And there are times where I just, if I don't feel like the text is making one cohesive statement, such as, I mean, Paul's all over the place in his epistles.
Yeah.
So there are times where grace for ourselves is needed for sure. But I find that what's helpful for me is I'm a very, I'm not a systematician. I am much more of a biblical theology guy, narrative theology. So it's a real discipline for me to try to systematize, to try to narrow down what I want to say into a few directions. And if I'm not disciplined there, and I know that the narrative pastors listening will relate to this, I can find that I try to say so much about so many different tributaries that I never actually get into the big lake. They're just these tributaries of streams of thought. And what I find is it's easy for us to throw fistfuls of sand at a congregation rather than a couple softballs. And I find that it's really, it doesn't help a congregation, because I believe teaching and preaching is foremost an act of compassion. So if it is an act of compassion where we're longing for a congregation to experience the greatness of God through the words that God has been faithfully transforming through history in, I think we've got to be disciplined to not try to say everything at once. And I have a really hard time with that as a narrative biblical thinker. I'm just not good at systems. I'm not good at breaking things down. So it's really helpful for me to do that discipline, because I know my tendency is just to talk. So I try to really hone in on that.
Yeah. And so when you come to Wednesday and you're thinking through, it's helpful for you to do something that's against your nature. Do you have a particular organizational structure that you try to fit everything into every week, or do you just look to see what's emerging from your study?
Absolutely. I have zero grid. Sometimes I'll even go to my Baptist roots, which I grew up in, and use alliteration. A lot of times I'll just, I'll use, from to imperatives, where God's calling us from shame to acceptance, you know, that kind of format, where I find people can see, oh, this is what God wants to lead us out of. This is also what God wants to lead us into. So I find that there are times where I like to use X is greater than Y, such as transformation is greater than information, something like that.
Yep.
So it just depends on what I feel like the text is speaking, first of all, in me, and how that comes to bear in our congregation. And it's remarkable how time and again, preaching is a creative exercise, and time and again, the Spirit just births new ways of talking about the same things. So anyway, not trying to be novel, just trying to be faithful. But yet I do find that using different ways to boil things down, to throw a couple softballs, is helpful. So I don't feel any tyranny to say, well, it's got to be alliteration and it has to be P's, you know, or it needs to be 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
You know, that can be helpful if that's what comes off for you, but again, like, I just want to make it as helpful as possible to the congregation.
And I don't think you defined the organization piece that we're talking about as a day, but I assume that's Wednesday.
It's not a day. It really isn't. A lot of times that actually comes onto Tuesday. I am not a 40-hour a week into the sermon prep guy. I usually can write a sermon between 8 to 12 hours and find that's just a good rhythm for me. So usually, you know, Tuesdays, a little bit of time on Thursday, and then again on Sunday, I have that great, I have the great window on Sunday to not have to get up at 6 and cram everything in. But I have until, our first service is at 4:30. And so I'll have most of the day to reflect and make final, revisions and all of that. So.
Yeah. Okay. So devotional, exegetical, organization, what's step 4?
Contextual.
Okay, so that does
after, after the organizational, the contextual piece comes in, where I feel like I have a couple things that are sort of the overarching directions that I feel like are coming to bear for that particular week. And so within that, if we want to look at it like containers, I can begin to go to my online catalog that I've been amassing for the last, 5 years. I know a lot of pastors have been cataloging for decades, and it really is. It saves you hours.
We'll come back to that one.
Yeah.
I've got a note right here.
So that's the time for me to begin to mine through the Mark Sayers of this world, to mine through the John Tysons, to mine through the Kellers and all of the other people that influence you, where I can begin to look thematically or textually as to who has said what on what given topic, and begin to put them, if it's helpful, to those main points, those main containers, to begin to find room for, the great witnesses of our tradition to speak into it, the Desert Fathers and the other traditions that come to our faith throughout church history. So that's really helpful for me.
So you're surprising me here, though, because when you were saying contextual, what I was imagining was talking in particular to the people of Chelsea or the people of Manhattan, but you're speaking about it more as if it's engaging with what other contemporary Christian voices would have to say. Am I understanding you right?
Not just contemporary, but historical voices. Okay. So the contextual piece, I actually find that patristics have more to say to our current context than many writers today.
But you're more talking about the scriptural context and the cultural context. Maybe that's where I should go with it.
That's right. I'm not thinking of the contextual context in terms of scriptural's context. I'm thinking of contextual as to what's going to what material is out there outside of scripture, outside of commentaries, that this is really going to land in my context.
Got it.
To add sort of fuel to whatever it is that has been said in commentaries in light of the scripture. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
I probably could find a better, more specifying term for that for the sake of this podcast. But
too late. It's out there.
Sorry, guys. You can turn this off now.
Okay. And then so then step five would become
sacramental. So the last is how does all this bear on where we're going with the Eucharist? And with the Eucharist, there's always the general remembrance and encounter theme of fellowship and of sacrifice. But I also find that there's also specific nuances within each text, within each week, that the Spirit's wanting to do. And I'm very particular about the way in which we do Eucharist as well, not like we figure it out and everyone else is wrong. For the sake of our community, I'm really big on people rising from their seats, from their pews, and coming. They're being summoned to the table. So it's passive in that we receive it, but it's active in that you have to come to it. You're being invited to it. So with that, I try to tie in whatever I'm preaching on to actively respond to it, to come to this, whether it's, let's just say it's a week where it's about abiding and we're going through John 15 rather. It's that idea that coming, responding to being rooted in Jesus, and so come to the table with that in mind, because there's mysterious transformation for you as you are on your way to the Eucharist, if that makes sense. So all of my preaching culminates in the sacrament. So I'm always thinking about how the Eucharist comes to bear on any particular text.
Yeah. So let's go back to this. Well, we'll get to this catalog question in a second. Are you a Bible software user, or you just have bookshelves?
I do. Yeah, I have Logos. I find that I don't use it as much as I once did, although I think it's been helpful to some extent. I have just kind of found the men and women that I feel like really speak to my heart and really speak to my context. And I try to capitalize on those voices when I feel like it's germane to the text.
Got it. Okay. So talk about this 5-year catalog you've built. What does that look like? How do you do it? Because actually one of the things I've been surprised about, I think you're in the late 20s, 28 maybe. I've been surprised how few people do really keep a developed catalog of ideas. So many people's process is so ephemeral, like this is what I have going on right now. So talk more about that. How do you keep catalog? What is it? How do you structure it? Where is it?
Yeah. So years ago, a good friend told me to keep an online blog. And what I find is, for those of you with photographic memories, great. Congratulations. I don't have one of those. Most of us don't. And John Tyson does. And so it used to really bother me because he could just pull quotes out of his hat. And gosh, he's just a phenom about that stuff. And he just remembers things that is crazy. John's the founding and lead pastor of Trinity Grace as a whole. And I realize I don't have a photographic memory, and I read all the time. I love to, I just eat books. And so, especially if I'm going to be purchasing books on my budget, I don't want them just to be for my nourishment, but how do they come back to actually nourish the body at large? And so I found that keeping an online blog that's hidden, and what I do, I also have, there's an app that the blog source I use has an app on the phone. So this blog is accessible on all of my machines right now. So whether I'm just on my phone and I think of something that I want to record, or I'm reading something and I want to record, at any moment, I usually have at least one machine on me. I can turn and not feel like I need to remember it, not feel like I need to write a lot about it and move away from talking to my wife or my friend or whomever, but can just make a quick note about it on this hidden blog that I theme it in the subject line. So whether it's the text or whether it's, let's say, on love, or let's say it's on sacrifice, or let's say it's on vengeance or whatever, right? And then I just source it in the main part of where you would blog. So I'll say, you know, location 636 of, you know, whomever I'm reading that day.
Yeah.
And so what I do then when I go back to this part of, to the contextual piece, part four of my sermon prep, is after I've done sort of the organizational work, I'll then say, okay, if I'm, like for this particular week, I'm speaking on covenant. And so I'll just do a word search for covenant, and it'll pull up all of the things I've read throughout the last 5 years that I've cataloged under covenant. And it just really helps me maximize my reading time. So it's just a much more faithful way for me to feel like I'm reading not just for the present, but for the future. So for those of you without a photographic memory, it's just a really good resource to have. And I have found that it probably saves me, on average, you know, a good 2 to 3 hours of trying to find something more. And at the same time, I feel like I find, at least in New York, my congregation is very fascinated about what Nietzsche had to say about something, you know, decades ago. I find that my congregation is very fascinated by what Jacques Ellul might have to say about World War II, about this particular topic, that we might, you know, be talking about with the text. So, you know, it's a really great thing when I start pulling in other sources of voices throughout, the generations. It just really, I feel like, gives my preaching a much wider lens than just, hey, I've been thinking about some things, and this is what the first century had to say about it when Paul. And though that in itself is fine, and that God uses that, I just find that in urban contexts, people love to hear Plato sourced. You know, people love to hear just a wider swath of voices that are contributing to the material that we're talking about today.
I think in urban contexts, and maybe this is true in others, but even people who don't read want to read. And so feeling like they're even learning broader principles from you because you're engaging with these it extends some credibility to you because they feel like they're gaining more than the message that you... Does that make sense? You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like they're reading through you, or you're reading on behalf of them. So... Without giving away the private blog, like do you have something set up on WordPress.com? Or if somebody wanted to replicate what you're doing, what's your setup for it?
Yeah, so I think most of the blog sites would work. I found Blogger is what I use. I think that might be WordPress. I don't even know. I use Blogger, and it's, again, you can get it on an app as well. So it's linked on all my machines, and it just allows me to always be cataloging. So,
and so the Blogger app also lets you search all your stuff.
It does. Nice. It's much more difficult on a phone to do that, but it is possible.
Okay. Yeah. Which, I mean, I do a lot of WordPress stuff, and I assume you could do the same with that. So, well, that's interesting. That is not, when you talked about an online catalog, that's, you know, so many people use Evernote and those kind of things, but you found this other system that works. It's just kind of fun to see how people do it.
Yeah, I'm sure, you know, I have Evernote. I've just not, by the time I got Evernote, I had already developed the system. And if Blogger ever goes off, it just disappears, I'll be in huge trouble. But I think it's probably in for the long haul.
You can get everything out of there. Well, see, and I remember sitting with John Tyson, years ago, probably the last time you and I hung out in person or close to it. And he was at the time doing a lot of reading on his iPhone. And anytime he found something he really liked, he just took a screenshot of it and saved it to Evernote because he knew Evernote could search the words to it. So
it's great.
That cracked me up. So you sent me a document right before we started about your preaching philosophy, and I'll post that on the website, the sermonsmith.com website. But talk about what that document is and how it might be helpful to extend this conversation.
Yeah, that document is, I came to a place after 14 years of preaching. We as pastors go away every 8 to 10 weeks, to just sync up, walk into our brother. I mean, we meet every Monday as well, but we get out of the city every few weeks together to continue just to mind through this stuff. And one of the pastors posed an incredible question. He said, do we have a philosophy of preaching? He said, do any of you have like a go-to? You actually are operating in use out of a philosophy that you're coming to week after week. And none of us did. None of us. And it really got me thinking that I want that. I really do. So I came up with my own philosophy that was sort of both how I have been operating, edited with some of my time with Willimon, and then after that really putting together some of my aspirations of how I want to be structured. And what I came up with was a process, an approach, and sources. So, like, for example, what I just gave you was the process of my philosophy of preaching. I also have an approach part of the document that you'll find, meaning that I want my first approach to be theological, not anthropological. I think the scriptures want to talk about God first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And so I want to make sure that my foremost place that I start with is Trinitarian, before I get to the anthropological influences and implications of it. And then third, it's testimonial, of having narrative support for what I want to say in my content. So all that's in there, and it's just trying to be faithful to the order, I guess. Because I find that in sermon preparation, the order in which you do things, it reveals your priority of the weight of what you're giving certain sources of voice into your kerygma, into your proclamation, into your preaching. So it's been really helpful for me to come up with a philosophy that I might really self-understand my own priority when I preach.
Gotcha. Sorry, I'm scratching things down as you talk. Maybe even just for my own benefit. This is a question that's not my standard questions. I just know to be true of you. Like, I know you've written a curriculum on, essentially, if I can call it this, an urban discipleship curriculum. Mm-hmm. Is that a good terminology for it?
Yeah, it's called Urban Disciple.
Yeah. Well, see, it is good terminology. You know, and I know that you've recently been, is your next one already published? Talking about just the need to find quiet?
Yeah, so I published a little Protestant primer for contemplative spirituality called Quiet, Hearing God Amidst the Noise. I gave you the subtitle because there's a book that came out last year called Quiet on Introverts.
Oh, yeah.
And it's huge and it's fantastic and it definitely dwarfs mine. So I
will publish, I mean, I'll include links to both of those on the website, in the notes for the show. But the reason I bring that up, the question I have for you, and what really brought this question to mind is you're talking about how you took the time to bang out this philosophy of preaching. It seems like you're fairly prolific at being able to collect thoughts and put thoughts together in a format to be consumed by others. We're talking sermons, we're talking books, this philosophy of preaching that was for yourself. What do you find is helpful for you to be able to change gears between these different projects? Because preaching alone and that degree of content to be developed every week can take a lot out of somebody. So do you have to have intensive seasons where you're working on the other projects and less preaching, or do you find rhythms to help you do the others?
Yeah. I mean, I wish I had like a better answer for that. I find that I'm becoming more introverted and introspective as I get older. And I find that helps me to really pin down, what am I feeling? What have I been learning? And in any way, is that useful for others? Like, quiet came about just because I had been on a 7-year journey of needing to like really stop playing games with my prayer life and acting like I had one. So I got introduced to being with God rather than speaking at God in my prayer life, although I think we both are needed. And just kind of realized that after 7 years, I felt like I had something to contribute, at least my own parish. And as I did it, it was like, oh, this could actually maybe be helpful for other parishes and churches and Christians abroad. So for me, everything begins in what is locally going to be helpful. And then I sort of begin to assess, okay, maybe this has a translocal voice or maybe even a transnational voice that I could, you know, perhaps put it on a bigger platform. So, and we have the tools today to do that through even self-publishing.
Yeah.
So it's, I find though that, like, for instance, The Quiet is simply a doctoral paper that I wrote several months ago. That's all it is. It's a paper that I wrote for a professor, and he said, you should publish this. And I did it, and it's done surprisingly well. So it's just like, it all sort of really begins local with me. And like Urban Disciple, I wrote that so that people in my congregation could walk through the life of Jesus together. And from there, it just kind of spiraled into a bigger project of making it available. And now we have churches across the world that use it. And it's just been hilarious to me because I don't start there at all. Like, I'm not trying to have a bigger voice, or it just happens to where it's helpful for other contexts. There are some projects I do that aren't helpful at all, even for my own context, that they say, nah, we're not going to use this. So it just, sometimes you just stumble upon those works that you feel like you can kind of scale. And yeah. So that's where they do that. But the 12-hour message prep for me gives me a little more margin to write an article for a publication or to work on a book on the side. And I stay pretty committed to my time frames. Like Urban Disciple came about because I wrote it over the course of 2 years with a 9 to 12 framework on Wednesday mornings. That's all it was, 3 hours, 9 to 12 on Wednesdays. You'll find that every year, if you're faithful to something, you'll have something worthwhile for yourself, your local congregation, and possibly beyond them. So that's sort of the pattern that I use, is just small doses of faithfulness actually pay like dividends in the long run. And it actually gives you more creative ideas of what to do with it the longer you stretch it out. Because if you're trying to get something to market, you can really get yourself in a lot of trouble and shortcut really the breadth of what it could be, and certainly the depth of what it could be.
Well, yeah, it's certainly not a matter of, you know, I'm actually, this is something on my mind right now because I'm writing it for an article, but ideas breed ideas, creativity breeds creativity. And so it's not that you're going to run out of ideas. It's just a matter of forming those ideas into something.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for that. Let me ask you a couple of starting to wind down questions. You mentioned Mark Sayers, who I just had a conversation with my friend Jonathan Dodson here in Austin this morning about Mark Sayers, because he's bringing him to town. So I'm curious, one or two standout books of his that you think, oh man, start here.
I think for your congregation, it was the one on Kerouac, The Road. Like I said, I don't have photographic memory. I bloggered it, so I don't have to remember anything anymore. I'm looking it up right now, as a matter of fact. But the one I found recently that's particularly helpful for pastors is The Road Trip That Changed the World. It's by Sayers, just the one I was mentioning.
Yeah.
Really helpful, I think, for particularly for postmoderns that are viewing their life through a series of experiences and not really attached to anything, is really helpful. I feel like it's a great rebuke on our time, loving rebuke, that is. His recent one, Facing Leviathan, I thought was really helpful. I found it incredibly scriptural and yet incredibly sociological. He did a full-on workshop here for us a few weeks ago, and it just really blessed our people and really has challenged our pastors. I find his cultural insights are really helpful. And Facing Leviathan, I feel like, is a really helpful recovery from some of the organic church trajectory that's led us so far in one direction, where it can kind of preserve some of those things, but at the same time kind of bring some of the older things to come back into existence to create a more robust, healthy perspective, I think, for a local church.
Nice.
He can bring those worlds together in a way that I feel like is really healthy for us.
Yeah, and that's the one Jonathan told me to get into.
Yeah.
Talk about other books that have been helpful for forming who you are as a preacher, or that you feel are just helpful resources for preaching, maybe on an ongoing basis.
Well, I'll speak into the second one. I would say I glean into the great Christian tradition. I wish we were part of a tradition here, a denomination. We're not. However, I find that there are so many voices and so many Christian traditions throughout the course of time that are worth hearing. And so I would say in recent days, in terms of philosophy of preaching, Thomas Long, Will Willimon, have been really big for me to learn from them and some of the things that that they bring to bear on from their generation, because they speak from a different generation too, and I think it's great. I have felt called back to something. Obviously, Fred Craddock has so much to say. If you're looking for a great read on the Old Testament and preaching the Old Testament, Ellen Davis has been amazing for me. Wonderful, wonderful Duke professor. So those are the places that recently I've been reading a lot from. James Kay, obviously, is a legend. So those voices have just been huge in my life, probably this last year, as I've really tried to get more crystallized on a philosophy of preaching.
Is Ellen Davis, did she write Scripture, Culture, and Agriculture?
I believe she did, yes.
Yeah, okay. As soon as you said her name, that was ringing out. Mm-hmm. Tell me that I've got Thomas Long on my bookshelf, but I can't spot the title from here. What did he write?
His book, The Witness of Preaching, fantastic. He was really helpful, especially as a preacher. I think sometimes you're graded by congregations, and the congregations don't realize that there are kinds of preachers, and they're trying to fit you into one category because it's all they've known or it's their favorite. And it's really helpful for a pastor who feels like he's perhaps a poet, and not a herald. And so it just gives you some things to draw from to understand even your own identity and own unique call within preaching.
And Will Willimon, book that's particularly helpful, any specific titles?
Yeah, let me give you, this one was really helpful for me at Easter because I know that sort of the weight we feel as preachers throughout the calendar year to deliver the spectacular message every Easter,
yeah,
where you're just trying to one-up yourself every single year and it's just not healthy. So a book he wrote called Easter, Keeping Preaching Fresh. I'm sorry, it's called Undone by Easter, Keeping Preaching Fresh, Undone by Easter. And it really gave me a sense of calm moving into the Easter message that our congregations actually aren't coming on Sunday on Easter to hear something new. They actually want to hear the story retold. Doesn't mean you can't have fresh nuances, but some of the weight we put on ourselves as preachers is just so unhealthy, and it's just so about us, and it's so about us making it a bold step for ourselves in a name and needing to be felt important. And yet God moves and not always in what's novel, but in what's faithful. So that was really helpful for me this Easter.
Yeah. I decided a couple of years ago just to give myself permission every year at Christmas and every year at Easter, the story of the incarnation and the story of resurrection, those are just worth telling again. And not trying to dress them up and all that, and just let this be a story that shapes who we are as a people, rather than let's try to, oh my gosh, let's make Easter interesting again. We've all heard it so many times. We're talking about resurrection. That's pretty fantastic.
right.
So, well, AJ, thanks. I will wind this down, but is there anything you feel like pertinent to preaching, most particularly sermon preparation, that you feel like we haven't even talked about that you would want to chime in this conversation?
I don't think you can say enough about making sure, there's two polar extremes. I think we go to one extreme where it's all about, stories and telling compelling narratives from your congregation and from the world. And then you go to the other extreme where it's all just about witness and dynamic theology and proclamation and heralding. I don't think we can go far enough to keep ourselves accountable with both sides of the coin. That every proclamation needs a good story. And every good story needs an orthodox proclamation. So that's one of the things. And every time I teach, I always want to be careful that I'm doing both in a way that says this story needs some color, or this proclamation needs some contemporary color, or this contemporary color, it's got to have a rooting greater than just, you know, I was talking to Dan the other day, and this is what he said. You know, so those are some things I try to do to make sure that, I mean, that's just not even rocket science, and pastors probably listening saying, well, duh.
It's a helpful reminder, though.
But we get done preaching, and people come up to us, and they say, man, I really connected with it. I really wish you would just tell a story to illustrate it. And we think, oh, I guess I didn't do that. Or they just hear stories all the time. They're like, man, I'd really like to see where this is in Scripture. And you think, oh, I thought I was doing that. I guess I wasn't. And so things like that I've just found over the course of my time are really good medicine to just stay, do both. What it meant and what it means. Both of those matter.
Yeah. Well, AJ, thanks a ton. It's great to talk with you. I'll also comment, speaking of the writing stuff, we've both been writing for the V3 Movement blog, and I've enjoyed some of the things you've written there. That's what made me think about it. I should ask AJ to be on this, because I was reading one of yours there and thought, oh, he'd be good to have on SermonSmith. So
it's been an honor to be on it.
I'll link to some of those things too.
Sounds good.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your time, AJ.
You're welcome.
Blessings.